श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, धन्यवाद, गुड मॉर्निंग। एंड वी आर कंटिन्यूइंग with our series of morning lectures, at least morning over here. And today we have already received some inquiries during these days along the week. So from the Buddhists who are not able to connect live because of different timings in their particular countries and so on. So with your permission, we will begin presenting those two. But of course, in case you have any other question or topic, you can also share it and we'll see where all this ends up today. How much time we may have and so on. So I'll begin with one question sent by Ashrin Jagdiani. So the question is as follows. He says, are demons like Puttana, Tatastha Jivas, or are they Sarup Shakti Nitya Parishads? From the Aho Vakiyam verse, it seems like Puttana and other demons are Tatastha Jivas. But if that is the case, then how can there always be Jivas available to serve, if you will, as Puttana, Keshi, Kaliya, and so on? It is probably my limited thinking that it is not able to understand this, but can you speak more, some more on this? So that's the question. I'll kind of repeat it or reframe it and clarify some of the details in the question as part of the reply, my reply to the question. And of course then we will go with a more official answer, if you will, to the inquiry itself. So Ashwin is asking if asuras like Puttana or others, if he's asking in plural, so Puttana is like a well-known, or even if you will, the very first asura in the list of asuras that attempt to kill Krishna, if you will, in Braj, just after he was born, after a few days he was born. Puttana is the very first personality which comes to this scene, sent by Kamsa from Mathura, being the sister of Bakasur, Agasur, and so on. So the question is if Puttana or other demons are in their, if you will, constitutional makeup, Tatastha Jivas, Tatastha Shakti, or do they belong to the Sarup Shakti department? Are they, in other words, Nitya Parishads, or eternal associates, part of the permanent retinue of Bhagavan? And then in connection to Puttana, again, it's the question kind of mentions Puttana over and over again, but it's at the same time speaking concerning, asking about any other demons. So there comes, he says, the ad from the Ahovakiyam verse, it seems like Puttana and other demons are Tatastha Jivas. So which is this Ahovakiyam verse? It's a famous, well-known shloka from Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, pronounced by Uddhava. Ahovakiyam shtana kala kutam jikyan sayapayat apyasatvi lebhengatingatri chitam tatonyam kambandayalum sharanam rajema. Very nice verse, and quoted here and there, and created so many wonderful results. In those who invoke the verse, in those who hear the verse, we have this famous case of Mukunda invoking this verse when Gadadhar Pandit is doubting about Pundarik Vidyanidhi's standing, by seeing Pundarik Vidyanidhi as an apparent Vishai. So Mukunda sings this particular verse to invoke a whole a current of sattvic bhavs, ecstatic symptoms in Pundarik Vidyanitha, Gadadhar realizes, oh, he's a Mahabhagavat. He was hiding behind this apparent appearance of sense enjoyment, but actually he's very high personality. So this verse was the one who showed who was Pundarik Vidyanidhi. So if you see someone engage in gross sense enjoyment, and you may have the doubt, maybe this person is an avadut, great personality, you can quote this verse and see what happens. So in this verse, basically, Uddhava is saying, he begins by expressing chamatkar, the very essence of rasa, rasasar chamatkar, which is astonishment. Astonishment. How can one surrender to someone more merciful than Krishna? Basically, this is the gist of the verse, who gave Putana the position of a mother while she approached him dressed like as something else, if you will, as a well-wisher, while trying to kill him, actually. So that's the worst possible scenario you can imagine. And Krishna invokes or promotes her to the best possible scenario you can imagine, Vatsalya Bhavin Golok. So this totally contrasting extreme example of causeless mercy makes Uddhava conclude, how can one possibly surrender to someone more merciful than Krishna? In other words, there's nobody else more merciful than him. So the point is, from that verse, it seems, Ashwin says here, like Putana, other demons are tatasta jivas, by showing their basically not so favorable position on one side, on one point, and they're being promoted to a particular great position on another point. So it seems, okay, they were tatasta jivas who were promoted to that situation, not always in that favorable situation. And then the question, the real question, if you will, comes, then if that's the case, how can there always be jivas available to serve as Putana, Keshi, Kali, etc.? And some afterthought comes, maybe it's my limited thinking that is unable to understand all this. So, in brief, we could say, I personally never came in touch with a statement that may say that all these asuras who participate in the lila are nitya parishads of Bhagavan. Now, that said, we shouldn't run to the other extreme of the black and white, and in black and white terms. Okay, if all of them are not made of Swarup Shakti, then all of them must be Tathasta Shakti. No, that's not the case either. To begin with, some technical clarification. In the question, Ashwin is asking if the asuras are tatasta shakti or tatasta jivas or swarup shakti nitya parishads. And in connection to the latter, I would like to clarify that not necessarily all nitya parishads are swarup shakti, made of swarup shakti, if you will. Although most of them are presented as such, there is some mention, given the example of Garuda, by Srila Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. I don't remember the exact section or verse now. But he's mentioning, hinting at the possibility of Tathasta Shakti Nitya Parishads, which may not be the rule, but maybe an exception to the rule, but nonetheless, that's possible. Some jivas composed of Tathasta Shakti who have been always there rendering some seva. Again, some brief clarification, that's not the main point of the question. So going to the answer of the question, although already I said something, let's try to further unfold some thoughts. So no, not necessarily all of these asuras are Tathasta Shakti, nor necessarily all of these asuras are Sarup Shakti entities. So yes, in some examples we can see that some people have a background that is not that favorable, and we never hear that they were in Vaikuntha or they were in Golok and they came to earth as part of the retinue of the Lila and so on, and they play the part of an asura for some particular purpose. We do not hear about that for every single asura. Actually, we do not hear that about that with almost any asura, but there are some exceptions to the rule. So let me continue by describing some of the exceptions to the rule, which actually speak of asuras who are coming from above, or we may say who are constituted of Swarup Shakti. So one famous example that immediately maybe comes to mind of most of you is Jai and Bijai. So Jai and Bijai are the gatekeepers of Vaikuntha. They are depicted as such in the Bhagavatam and other Puranas. So to be a gatekeeper in Vaikuntha, you have to be part of Vaikuntha. It's not they are gatekeepers because they are outside the gate. So they are actually not in Vaikuntha, but in the gate. And again, all this doesn't have to do with geographical location. I know it's maybe not so easy to conceive, but please do not think in terms of physical movement to get from here to Vaikuntha. No? Sometimes some depictions are there to illustrate the point that there's a movement in awareness from one place or direction to the other, but it's not that we are being carried from here to Vaikuntha in some airplane or something, although those descriptions are there. For example, when Dhruva Maharaj, he's described as being taken in an airplane, airship, along with her mother in another airship from Earth to Vaikuntha. So again, you can take that literally and wait for your airship to come at the end of this life or whatever life may come and being taken there. But we have to also keep, in this particular case, I will recommend, try to consider the symbolic interpretative meaning, which is what's this airship, what this journey about. No, it's a movement in terms of awareness and consciousness. And as I always say, and it's not that, okay, I am living this life in a certain consciousness and suddenly I leave this body and my consciousness totally switched and I'm transported into Golok and I'm there. No, for you to be there while leaving this body or after leaving this body, you will have to have been there already there before leaving this body, to one degree or another. It's not that it's totally different from one thing to the other. Actually, in connection to the bhakti conception, bhakti is the means and bhakti is the goal. So there is not so much difference. You will be living your life. If you are living your life in a perfectly devotional way, you won't even perceive that you have left your body. Because what's happening before your physical death and after your physical death is mostly the same thing. Before your physical death, if you are, again, the topmost devotee, you are rendering pure seva, loving seva to Bhagavan and so on. And after the demise of this body, you will keep doing the same thing. So try to, it's important that we think about these things. So, again, going back to the gatekeepers of Vaikuntha, which it's a state of consciousness, we know that it is mentioned that Jai and Bijai were cursed by the four Kumars, long story, 7th canto, to fall from Vaikuntha and to take birth as demons, three births as demons, and sometimes even the devotees say, I've heard this, and I repeat this in the early years without thinking too much about that. So I beg my forgiveness for that. But sometimes the idea was, okay, they were offered to be reborn three times as demons, or I think five times as devotees in their quote-unquote falling although nobody falls from Vaikuntha, and we know that. another topic. So they chose to be born three lifetimes as demons. And sometimes it is said they wanted to be born three times as demons, so they were the last possible time on earth, so they will return to Vaikuntha. So again, this notion of returning and leaving physically, geographically a place, that's a misconception. You know, that if you understand the nature of bhakti, if you understand the nature of Vaikuntha, you will understand this cannot happen. To begin with, because if a devotee is purely serving Bhagavan, that devotee is already in heaven or beyond heaven. For us, heaven is Swarga, and the devotee is way beyond that. But that's our heaven is Golok. And again, he's already there. Like when Krishna is showing after Nanda Maharaj, as you know, is kidnapped by the agents of Varuna, and eventually Krishna is rescuing him, and they both return, but Nanda Maharaj is seeing how all these servants of Varuna and Varuna himself worship Krishna and praise him with full Aishwarya. Nanda Maharaj returns from that and starts to spread the news among the coward people, no? Because those are the news in the village. They don't have Wi-Fi and world news agencies or whatever. So whatever happens, everyone knows after 5 minutes. So, and what if that involves Krishna and such an extraordinary situation? So after Nanda Maharaj starts to share this with other cowherds, they start to think in terms of, well, maybe Krishna is God, or maybe Krishna is something like that, or something close to that. And they get closer to him and say, we have realized you are so extraordinary. Can you please tell us which will be our next life? And you know how it goes. You know, Krishna tells them, close your eyes. He takes them to Akrutagat, close your eyes. And okay, now open your eyes. And like some magic trick, and they open and they see what? They see like a mirror in front of them. They see themselves with their cows, with their family members, with their houses. That's your next life, Krishna says. And they're all celebrating, happy. Okay, great. That's what we wanted. So that's the situation for a devotee. The devotee is beyond heaven and hell, if you will. Narayana parasarvina kutashana bibhyati sargapa varga narakesu apitulyartha darshina. For a devotee of Bhagavan, hell, heaven, all this stuff, liberation, swarga, apavarga, apavarga means mukti, narakeshu, hell, apituliartha darshina. He or she sees all this with equal eyes, in the sense, he's not attracted to any of those things. And if you pay in Vrindavan, you find this the ultimate meaning and application of this verse. You know, you see the Brajavasis, and as they really seem like totally attached people, attached to their houses and to the family. But this is an important point. They are pretty Sandarva. Jiva Goswami makes this point. They are attached to all those things only in connection to Krishna, as potential paraphernalia to be used in his service. And Rupa Goswami, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he speaks of this, he uses the term Bhava Vilas. Sometimes it's also called Tadiya Seva, which means you are attached to Krishna, but on top of that, you are attached to those things which are destined to be engaged in the service of Krishna. And that's the highest form of attachment. And that's what's going on in Vrindavan, famous example of Yashoda taking care of boiling milk, a vow taking care of Krishna, if you will. Direct service to Krishna, direct service to those things which are devotees in itself is a form of Vaishnava Seva, because everything in the dham, every even so quote-unquote inner object, is a servant. That's why Krishna says, Param chasubha sarde param param bhushana bhushanangam. Then martiri lapojikan sayoga, and so on. Bismasya chas... Bismasyana bismapanam swasya cha sobhagarde parampadam parampadam bhushana bhushanangam. The beauty of Krishna is beautiful to himself, and his ornaments actually get beautified in contact with him instead of him becoming beautified by the ornaments. So why Krishna is using ornaments? Also another explanation is the ornaments are devotees. So He wants to serve the devotees. And the devotees wants to serve him. So again, going back to the situation, Jai and Bijai, they say, give me three lives. We may think, or just only three lives, and then let me return here. But there's not question of leaving or returning to Vaikuntha. It's not, again, a physical movement, but it's a switch in consciousness. Under consciousness, it's not switching. As you know, they just let me become demons because they know Narayan wants to taste Virarasa. And to taste Virarasa, Virarasa means chivalry mood, some good, to have a good fight. And to taste a good fight, Narayan needs to do that with someone who is opposing him. But nobody in Vaikuntha will dare to offer Narayan a good fight. That's not the mood in Vaikuntha. Everyone is worshipping him in Dasya Bhav mostly, or Santa Prem, Santa Rasa, and so on. So they have to exhibit some opposing mood. But at the same time, there should be devotees doing that, so Narayan can really taste Rasa, Vira Rasa. So they ask, let us born as Asuras. They didn't ask, let's born as Asuras, so we return here as soon as possible. And again, they didn't fall, Jai and Bijai, just to clarify, they didn't fall because of the Kumaras' curse. Because the curse of sages like the Kumaras do not have any effect whatsoever in Vaikuntha, in its residence. They quote-unquote fell, again, quote-unquote, because of Lila Shakti, the influence of Lila Shakti. A curse cannot have any influence in Vaikuntha. It's like similarly when Narad Muni goes to Dwarka to visit Krishna. You know, in Dwarka, Krishna is married with 16,108 queens, and he has 16,108 not only palaces, but cities in which each palace is there. So you can imagine, if you want to visit all those places, that will take quite a long time. And Narad Muni went there to Dwarka, but you know, we have heard that Narad Muni was cursed by Daksha to not being able to remain in one single place for too much time. But we hear that Narad Muni went to Dwarka and he spent quite a long time visiting all these manifestations of Krishna, 16,108 cities, palaces, Krishnas, if you will. So the question is, but what about Daksha's curse? That he cannot remain too much in one single place. He remained in Dwarka, one single place, quite a time. And Jiva Goswami explains, yeah, but Daksha's curse is not effective in the Dham. And Dwarka is one of the divisions of Golok on earth. But that is manifest on earth doesn't make a difference. It's still one of the divisions of Golok. Mm-hmm. So there's no effect of those type of statements, if you will, or curses there. So the same way Kumar's so-called curse to the gatekeepers is not the cause of the real falling. Mm-hmm. There's no real fall because there is no real curse and so on. And even Narayan, when Narayan appears after the curse, he says, I could stop this curse, but I won't. I want this to happen. Again, some other purpose is there. Jai and Bijai themselves are powerful enough to stop that curse, but everything went on according to Lila Shakti's will. So Jai and Bijai fall, and they become covered by Lila Shakti, Yogamaya, who created this quote-unquote fall and covered them so they behave as demons. And they can offer a good fight to Krishna in three different births, as we know. Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, Ravana, Kumbhakarna, Dantavakra, Chesupa. And some bonus track added feature on Gorlila, Jagai, Madai. So, interestingly, of course, there are different degrees of discovering of Lila Shakti Yogamaya. For example, in Brahma Vimohan Lila, we know that at one point, when after almost a year has passed, and Krishna had expanded in the form of every calf and every cowherd boy, when Brahma, quote-unquote, kidnapped them, actually didn't happen, but he thought that. And Baladev was saying, the cows are too much affectionate for the calves, like never before, and the same with the parents, with the kids. What's going on here? So it is said that Balaram himself acknowledged, I have been covered by the maya of my Prabhu, of my master. On some degree, Jiva Goswami says in Pritisandarbha, not on the full degree. On some degree, in the sense, Baladev's loving feelings for Krishna remained. although he was covered for a moment. But in the case of Jai and Vijay, they were much more fully covered because their loving feelings toward Bhagavan did not remain. Of course, they are there, but in the outward expression of how the Leela plays out, they want to kill him. Again, they want to give him a good fight in Vidaras. So similar things, for example, with Putana is something similar. When Putana enters Vrindavan, she appears as if Lakshmi Devi. Not like Lakshmi, no, it's not that it is Lakshmi herself, but it is as if Lakshmi Devi have appeared. That's how the Vrajvasi thought. And it is said, okay, but and Putana is a demon, it's an asura, it's not, again, it's not a Nitya Parishad, we don't hear that. Mm-hmm. So the point is, how to conceive that the Vrajavasis feel attracted towards her beauty, because that's mentioned in the Bhagavatam. They feel attracted towards her beauty, but how someone like a Vrajavasi who only feels attracted towards the real beauty, if you will, towards Krishna, the all-attractive and all that is related to him, they felt attracted towards a cheating lady dressed up as something that she was not. So again, the Acharyas mentioned that was the arrangement of Lila Shakti, covering the vision of the Vrajavasis and making them feel, one of the different explanations in that connection. So this Jai Vijay, again, and there are so many things that it's interesting when you unpack the implications of this that are important to consider from a proper angle. For example, and maybe not related exclusively to the question, but it's like an afterthought of the question. For example, Jai and Vijay. We are speaking about them. As Nitya Parishads made of Swarup Shakti appearing as demons. So they, in their third birth, they appear as Sisupal and Dantavakra. Just to mention, concentrate for a moment on one of these examples. So, as Sisupal, we may know the story, you know, he attacked Krishna many times and he was defeated over and over and over again. So, to make a long story short, when he's killed by Krishna, he's killed by Sudarshana. And Sudarshana is invoked on the discus of Bhagavan and beheads Sisupal. Sudarshan also means proper vision, Sudarshan. So it's replacing the head, it's replacing the vision, if you will. And it is said that he was harboring, again, in the context of the Leela, unfavorable feelings towards Bhagavan. Again, remember, it's one of the gatekeepers of Vaikuntha, but under the influence of Leela Shakti, is acting as if he's in the role of, totally engrossed in that character by the influence of Yogamaya, not having favorable feelings. So when the Sudarshan chakra is cutting his head, it is said that it's freeing him from all that negativity. But it is said that since in that particular life, as Sisupal, in that particular moment, as that character, Sisupal had not any bhakti samskars. Again, we are speaking about the Nitya Parishad in Vaikuntha, but some sub-explanation is there according to his life as Sisupal. He didn't have any positive devotional attainment, so he was freed from all negative influence. Quote-unquote negative, again, it's a Nitya Parishad, by the Sudarshan, total purification of all possible negativity, but no positive attainment was there. So which was the end result? If you remove all negative thing and no positive thing remains, and result was Brahma Sayuja. So it is mentioned in Shastra that Sisupal attained Brahma Sayuja. But again, we are saying he's one of the two gatekeepers of Vaikuntha. So of course, they are not being sent to Brahman forever because they are eternal in Vaikuntha. But these things are being mentioned to make a point, basically, of what may happen if that will be the case with someone who actually is a demon and is not actually a gatekeeper of Vaikuntha. So we have to put all the things in place so we are not just repeating the narrative and actually contradicting many points in our own repetition without even realizing that. So basically that would be the idea. No? Not necessarily all demons are Nitya Parishads. mostly the main example we hear is, again, from all the forms that Jaya and Bijaya took eventually. But regarding most of the other ones, generally this idea is being described. They are, for example, Putana, we hear about her previous life as Ratnamala. She was the daughter of Bali Maharaj. You know, in other Puranas this is mentioned, and she, when she saw Bamandev approaching her father, she felt so much motherly attraction to him that she felt, oh, I would like to take him on my lap and breastfeed him. But of course, eventually when she saw how Bamandev, if you will, cheated on Bali Maharaj when requesting these three steps of land and so on, she changed totally her view and said, I would like to poison that boy, to kill him. So in their next life, those two desires combined in the form of Putana. She was able, trying to kill him, but by breastfeeding him and taking him on his lap. And of course, the end result was Vatsalya Bab. Because there was some Vatsalya in the previous lifetime. Krishna remembered that. Oh, she had some Vatsalya, now she's coming as a devotee and so on. But we do not hear a mention that they were necessarily eternal associates or something like that. So there is place for the two things. Some eternal associates appearing as demons, but as I mentioned with Jaya and Bijaya, we have to properly understand in which sense they become demons, in which sense they fall from Vaikuntha, and so on. Or we have the other opportunity, someone being an asura and eventually becoming... And that happens, for example, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his Raghavarma Chandrika, and I know you are studying that, I don't know if you have finished everything, because at the very end, he starts to speak about the need for being born in the Prakat Lila, in order to attain the Aprakat Lila, to be born on the earthly Vrindavan, whenever the Lila is taking place on one particular planet Earth. He mentioned that at that moment, different types of people are being born when Krishna is manifesting his Lila on Earth. Some people will be his eternal retinue. Some other people will be devotees who are very advanced, who are just on the verge of attaining Aprakat Lilas, so who need to be born there. Some other people may be just casual people being there, if you want to call it in some way. They are not necessarily devotees. They are not necessarily, again, sadhana siddhas or advanced sadhakas, nor nitya siddhas. They are nor maybe asuras, just normal, innocent people. They happened to be there when the Lila took place. Some other may have negative emotions, and we see that in the Lila, no? When Krishna appeared and he traveled, for example, to Mithila, say that many people saw him and went to see him, but we never hear that they became devotees or attained prema or whatever. But they thought of Krishna as a great personality and they appreciated him, but it's not that they had total transformation. We hear now about other people who saw Krishna as an ordinary human being. He himself says that in the Bhagavad Gita. Some people misread me and thinking I'm just an ordinary living being. Manusyanam sahasritam. They think that I have taken shelter in a human form. But Mama Bhuta Maheshwaram, they don't understand I'm the Lord, overlord of everything. So my point is, It is possible that during Krishna's manifest Lila, different types of souls are there, and not necessarily all of them have a background of being Nitya Parishat or something like that. And that's important, and that gives hope. There are people with demonic mentality, let's say, and who may receive like the fortune that Putana received. And for us, also that's of great hope. Of course, because we may think, I mean, if you analyze the technical, the meaning, etymological meaning of the word asura, one of them is asu, which means like very quickly or as soon as possible. Asu, as soon as possible. Ra, asura, ra ramante. I want to enjoy ramante, asu, as soon as possible. Implying, I won't care about measuring the consequences of my acts. I just want to enjoy. That's basically one definition of And I want it now. No, we sometimes joke, there are some famous songs that say like, I want it all and I want it now, or something like this. So that's asura. So the point is, if we are quite sincere and introspective, we may realize, well, I'm not that far, I'm not very far from that. Or I was not that far from that before bhakti met me, if you will. So we can speak about this. And that's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur also describe all of these asuras in terms of different anarthas. Because sometimes we may feel, oh, Putana such a demon, or Agasura such a demon. And they're like implying there's much more demon-like than me. But when Bhaktivinoda Thakur is depicting them as different asuric mentalities, dispositions, and you can have more than one in your own case, you realize, oh, I was thinking that Keshi was much worse than me, that this demon was that much worse than me. But now I realize that I have a little bit of all of them in me. Or more than a little, or many, most of them in me. So who is the asura? What's the asura? Again, going back to the idea of a person or a disposition, a state of consciousness, as we spoke about geographical movement. About, in this case, we were speaking about demonic influences. And of course, Putana is more of an example, we could say, of Kripa Siddhi, of someone who received great perfection without engaging in basically any sadhana whatsoever, maybe having some very little desire, favorable disposition, or in a previous life, I would like to breastfeed him and then dressing as a Vaishnava. But technically speaking, that belongs more to the category of Kripa Siddhi. She attained perfection, but by undiscriminate mercy, without herself engaging consciously, voluntarily in sadhana for attaining that. So in one sense, of course, Putana's example gives us hope, but at the same time, we should not identify with the type of attainment that Putana attained, in the sense of, I also want to receive Kripa Siddhi. Because that's not something we can do anything about. We can just say that, but maybe we are saying that even out of laziness. I want to attain Kripa Siddhi, so I don't have to go through sadhana to attain sadhana siddhi. But actually, we should identify with the group of sadhana, aspirants to sadhana siddhi, to the perfection that comes out of practice. And of course, there is lots of mercy there as well, but there should be lots of practice as well. Kripa Siddhi means there was no practice. Krishna just, if you will, whimsically gave Siddhi to someone, but that's like winning the lottery. So I wouldn't recommend to you that, okay, I may win the lottery someday, so better I don't make any arrangement to study, to work or anything, because I may win the lottery and do not need to do anything else. Most probably you will never win the lottery. And ideally you should not be playing lottery as a Vaishnava. So as a Vaishnava, you should not be playing Kripa Siddhi lottery game. We should strive for sadhana siddhi. But nonetheless, again, the example of Putana gives us hope, because it's giving, shedding light on Krishna's merciful disposition and how much he becomes bhaktira prema chista krishna deki krishnera chamatkar, say Chaitanya Charitamrita. Bhaktira chesta deki krishnera chamatkar. When Krishna is seeing the loving efforts of his devotees, he enters into chamatkar. He becomes astonished by witnessing. He feels his heart is so moved by witnessing the sincere efforts and striving of his bhaktas. And of course, that means he reciprocates accordingly. Ye atman prapadyante tam sataiva bhajamya. So basically that's the idea. No? And there is no problem in thinking, just to finish, but how there can be always jivas available to serve as Putana, well, why not? I mean, there is no limited number of jivas. So there can be always someone who is ready to fit that post, if you will. No, no problem. There, if for jivas, in this case, we mean some with an unfavorable disposition towards Krishna, there are many, so no problem. Pick one, and that can, they can fit in the shoes of a Putana or a Keshi, because again, those asuric mentalities may be present in our psychology. So we ourselves may play the role of Putana and Keshi much better than playing the role of who knows who. So, and again, there's no limit of jivas, and yeah, maybe our mind and thinking cannot grasp how all this takes place, how the mechanics of how it all happens, because it's going on by the arrangement of potencies that even Maya Shakti is way beyond our capacity to conceive. Maya Shakti, what to speak of Lila Shakti, Yoga Maya. Of course, we are trying to do our best to grasp how this works and how to properly honor that. But we should be careful not trying to capture it all from that plane, because that in itself is Maya. The tendency to control through grasping, through understanding, to calculate through calculation. So it's important to know how to approach all the things. So anyhow, some thoughts. I hope that helps. And well, since there are no questions from the devotees present here, I'll go to the second question. and maybe this will be the last for today. Let's see. This was sent by Balaram Prabhu from New Zealand, who, due to the opposite, if you will, timings, their local timings, he's not able to connect. He must be taking rest now. So the question says like this. In the lineage of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, we see that Diksha is usually in two stages. First, Harinam, and then later, Mantra Diksha. Is this always the practice in the Saraswat line? Also, are you aware of any other Gaudiya lineages that also follow this practice? So I think the question is clear. There's no need to reframe it as it did with the other one, maybe, but of course we will, in replying to that, I hope that whatever doubt is there in the, regarding the question may be cleared up. So this is not maybe the top five of the most classical questions, but this is one question that at some point may come, especially when someone becomes familiar with different lineages, with different Gaudiya streams, if you will, which may do things relatively differently regarding certain aspects, like, for example, initiation and so on. So it's an interesting question, because again, it invites us to begin with acknowledge that there is not only one way of doing everything, which sometimes we may think like that in the beginning. No, that's, we have been speaking about that these days here in Argentina, how much the beginner's mind, because of his or her lack of hosting capacity, as I like to call it, his lack of capacity for accommodating certain nuanced expressions of bhakti, they need things to be in only one way. But of course, the problem with that, the potential problem, is that you need to have faith in that only one way. But the combination of having full faith in only one way is that you may think, okay, whatever else is there apart from this only one way is wrong. But in time, you will have to realize, no, it's not wrong necessarily. There's not necessarily one way of doing things. And this possibility not only starts to blossom as you get closer to a more mature intermediate stage, or you get associated with those people, but what to speak, in the Lila itself, it fully converges like that. There's a divine tension, if you will, a divine, how would I say, there's no separate interest, because everything has Krishna in the center, but having Krishna in the center, each one may have different ways, if you will, of having him in the center. As we say the other day, Yashoda wants Krishna at night to have a very sound sleep, go to rest. But the gopis do not have that, do not want that. The gopis want Krishna to sneak out with them the whole night. And again, both of them are not thinking in terms of separate interest, selfishness, exploitation, but just how can we offer ourselves in service to him. So there's no conflict ultimately in the Lila, but we will find this type of different ways of doing things. So that it also extends here into our realm of asadakas. Mm-hmm. So I given this brief introduction to mention that this is an example of that. Mm-hmm. And not only an example in which the line of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta does thing in one way and everyone else that thinks in another way, and there and we have only these two ways of doing things and nobody else does them in a third, fourth possible way, but there are nuances in how these two ways are being expressed as well. So it's again not black and white ever. So to begin with, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta's lineage here just mentioned that we usually see that initiation is, or diksha, the question says, is usually in two stages, Harinam and then mantra diksha. I will say in that case that that's not the case. If we want to technically speak about diksha, diksha is diksha. So diksha is mantra diksha. And Harinam is Harinam. Sometimes I've heard the expression Harinam diksha, but actually it's not technically correct, no? Because diksha is diksha and Harinam is Harinam. In one sense, there are two different things, although complementary. So diksha is diksha. What actually technically we call or translate as initiation, that's mostly connected with diksha. And when one receives mantra, which in this case, again, it may vary, differ in different lineages, mostly one will receive Gopal mantra and its corresponding Gayatri, Kam Gayatri. But in different lineages, some other mantras will be given, some other Gayatris will be given. Not only, again, in Bhaktisiddhanta lineage and other lineages, only two possibilities. There are many varieties in that. So Harinam is given, and there are different ways of doing so. Of course, in Shastra, it is said that Harinam is independent of Diksha. So Shastra is saying that, so of course it has a purpose. We are not to downplay any statement from Shastra or to think it's useless. Tattu Samam Bayat, says Vedanta Sutra, we have to harmonize, integrate every Shastric statement because all of them have some purpose. So if some of them seem to contradict one another, we have to properly harmonize them. So when it is said that Harinam is independent of initiation, one may think, okay, so I don't need to receive Harinam. Two things may happen. We could think, I don't need to receive Harinam from someone because it's independent of initiation. Generally, we understand initiation, someone gives me initiation. So if Harinam is independent of initiation, I don't need to receive that from anyone and I can chant. Another thing is, I don't need to receive initiation. Diksha, because Harinam is independent from Diksha, and by Harinam one can attain everything. So there's no need for initiation. So these two ideas may come by hearing this statement. Harinam is independent from Diksha. You follow? You can think, again, if Harinam is independent of Diksha, then I don't need to have Diksha in order to chant Harinam. I don't need to receive Harinam from anyone. Or another nuanced possibility, I don't need to receive Diksha at all because Harinam is all-powerful, all-complete. Nam Chintamanish Krishna Chaitanya Rasa Vignaha Purnasudha Nitya Mukta Vinatvam Namanamina and so on. So many things there. But these two readings of the verse are not complete, if you will. Because one is excluding the other thing, because also Shastra is speaking about the necessity for Diksha, for mantra Diksha. So again, what to do? So the way that, and again, there are different ways of harmonizing these statements. There is not, again, one single way. In the Saraswat line, if you want to call it like that, sometimes that's a name given for those who come in the disciplic succession of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, which generally also is known as Bhaktivinoda Parivar. The idea is, okay, yes, Harinam is independent of initiation because Harinam is Hari himself and he is Swarat, he's independent, he can give himself whenever, however he likes, if one approaches him. But also Hari, Harinam is different from Hari. And Hari is a person, and as a person, he has his own personality and his own way of doing things. He likes things to do be done in a certain way, and he likes, as we know, to give himself through the agency of his devotees. He has that particular preference. So if Hari likes to give himself through the agency of his devotees, and Harinam is not different from Hari, then Hari likes to give himself, come to our life through the medium of our the devotees. And that's why we receive Harinam from Sri Guru in our particular line. Again, in some other lines, maybe that may not be the case. The question has to do here with the line that comes from Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. So that's a point. And also, if you study, because okay, you have Harinam, and of course you can chant Harinam even before meeting Sri Guru, even before receiving that from someone officially, but our conception is, if you are chanting sincerely and properly, that chanting will take you to receive Harinam from Sri Guru. And as my Guru Maharaj likes to put it, mostly what you are receiving is, you are receiving the blessings from a particular, in that moment, to chant Harinam. You already were chanting, but now you are being specially blessed by some specific sadhu to chant Harinam under his or her shelter, and thus chant in the context of his or her guidance, be schooled, be instructed about how to further embrace your chanting in a more comprehensive way, and you will be receiving a particular connection from that sadhu, particular bhakti samskars, which will bear fruit in the form of Harinam, Hari, showing himself eventually in his Nam, Rupa, Guna, and Lila from a particular perspective, according to the samskars you have received from that sadhu, which will eventually flourish into a particular full-blown relationship you will have with Krishna in a particular rasa. So, that on one side. That's why Harinam is being given by the sadhu. Although technically speaking, that's not initiation. But it's a blessing to chanting Harinam in a particular shelter, with a particular connection. And also, going back to this idea of Harinam being independent of initiation, or being independent of having to be given by someone, at the same time, we have the list of namaparads that we recite, and one of them is Guror Abhagnya. Because if you want to chant Hari, Harinam, you have to be aware of how not to chant, if you will. And Guror Abhagnya is one of them, which means to neglect the principle of Sri Guru. So neglect the principle of Sri Guru means to forego initiation altogether in the name of Harinam is independent of Diksha. So I don't need Diksha. I just take Harinam by myself, don't need to receive any blessing, any connection. But that's offensive to the chanting. Again, Guru Abhagnya means you are expected to chant in connection to the principle of Sri Guru, under the shelter, under the guidance of a particular member of the parampara. So that implies, we could say, to eventually receive Diksha, official initiation by that Guru, but also for us, that also implies to receive Harinam from that person, to receive again the blessings, to engage in Harinam from that person, to create this sense of commitment in one particular direction in which I will try to surrender. And I in that sense understand also that Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, because the question also mentions, if I'm aware of any other Gaudiya lineages that follow this practice, I'm really not an expert on the historicity of how this particular situation has taken place in every single other Gaudiya lineage. But I wouldn't be surprised if we find some similar or identical expression in other lineages, or maybe if we don't found it at all. I mean, but again, my point is, beyond the technicality of how that takes place, the spirit of the law should be maintained, if you will, which is the sense of commitment with the department of Guru Tattva, and how that descending flow is crucial for us to actualize our connection with Harinam and what eventually mantra diksha will come from Guru. It's not that you give yourself mantra diksha in Shastra, that is mentioned over and over again. So I will say that, no, technically speaking, initiation is diksha. But Harinam, in the line of Saraswati Thakur, is being given, in some cases being given more liberally, if you will. In some other cases, there is a little bit more of time. I know that, again, Bhaktivedanta Swamiharaj Srila Prabhupada, he established a particular formula in regarding to initiation, also adjusting that according to the particular situation he was in the Western countries, regarding number of rounds or certain emphasis of on what we call the regulative principles, which we know does not there in other branches of the same Sarasvati line, if you will. The emphasis on the four regulative principles or that particular number of rounds. In some lineages, the emphasis will be more rounds, and other lineages may be less or adjust according to each individual case. Some others, more emphasis will be put on following Ekadasi or whatever. So again, my point is, there is some nuance expression of all this. But the principle, the underlying principle is the same, no? Commitment in connection with the representative of Bhagavan in our lives. So our service is being conducted under the guidance, with the blessings of a particular agent. So whether one is chanting Harinam and is not, has not ever received Harinam, eventually you are expected to receive mantra diksha from someone, and you are to commit with that someone. And probably before receiving mantra diksha, you have been chanting Harinam under the inspiration of a particular personality, and that's what's taking you eventually to mantra diksha. So the principle of connection and commitment with the sadhu has to be theirs. It's not that I chant Harinam out of myself, I never receive diksha from anyone, and just I attain perfection like that. There may be some exception to the rule, of course, in that connection, even in Shastra, but that's not generally the rule, but exception to the rule. Generally, what Shastra is mentioned is this complementary function in our particular lineage of Harinam and Diksha. And again, although Harinam is Hari and is therefore independent, and independent of Diksha, we could say it's just to make the point of how Harinam is non-different from Hari, who he happens to be, if you will, fully independent. But that statement is not mentioning, you just take Harinam independent, in an independent spirit, but not, if possible, try to connect your chanting of Harinam with the blessing of a sadhu. And naturally, that will take to mantra diksha, and naturally that will take to all that will follow. So again, that's for me, that's the main point of the question, or the reply to the question, beyond the how each particular lineage is doing all the things, which emphasis there is being put. I mean, the gist of the thing is the same. We are to embrace Harinam, mantra diksha. I mean, mantra diksha is composed of Harinam. You take out all the Harinam in mantra diksha, you no longer have mantra there, if you will. So Harinam is crucial in this too. And Harinam is not different from Hari, and we are not to address Hari directly. Again, because our goal is not Hari, our goal is not Krishna, our goal is Krishna Prem. So we are mostly interested in Krishna Prem, love for Krishna, Krishna Bhakti, Krishna. So the personifications of that feeling, of that emotion, which constitutes the goal. That's where we are most interested in, going back to my previous question. That's why this Bhavavilas or Tadiya Seva is considered of topmost importance. Like Mahadev told to Parvati. When Parvati asked Mahadev Shiva, which is the highest form of worship? And he said, Aradhananam Sarvisham Vishnur Aradhanam Param Tasmat Paratram Devi Tadiyanam Samarchanam. So he said, Aradhananam Sarvisham, of all types of worship, Vishnur Aradhanam Param. The supreme word of worship is of Vishnu, Narayan, Bhagavan, Krishna. And of course, at this point, Parvati is a little bit discouraged because she's worshipping Mahadev as her main deity. And now she realizes, oh, I'm not engaged in the highest worship. So she becomes a little bit discouraged. But then Mahadev says, Tasmat Paratram Devi, but, O Devi, above even the worship of Bhagavan, Tadiyanam Samarchana, the highest form of worship is the worship of those things which are dear to Bhagavan. Those things or those personalities. Because again, in the Leela, there's nothing which is a thing, even if it takes the form of an earring or grass or everything is totally with individuality and personality. So everything is a person. As my Guru Maharaj likes to say, reality is a person. We are not expected to describe reality in abstract terms, in personal terms. So Parvati was so happy because she realized, okay, those who are dear to Hari, to worship them, that's the highest thing. And Bhagavan and Shiva, Mahadev, he's Vaishnavanam Jata Sambhu, so dear to Hari. So I'm worshipping him. I'm on the right track, on the right place. Because again, why the worship of the Vaishnavas, why the worship of the paraphernalia, which is destined to worship Hari's higher? Because all of that is personifications of service, of the service attitude we want to attain, which is our cherished goal. So this is the main emphasis in the particular reply here regarding this question from Balaram Prabhu. So, thank you so much for your time. And if there have been any questions that you had for the ones connected present now, and we may spend some time next week dealing with those, so you can take them, send them to me during the week or whatever. And we will meet again next Friday at the same time, same channel. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Bol.